Hi, and welcome to the My Dog Made Me Do It Naturally podcast. I am your host, Kat Jepsen, a canine nutritionist with an innate obsession with dogs and the natural ways in which we are driven to live because of them. So, let's get to it. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the My Dog Made Me Do It Naturally podcast. Today, I am joined by a very special guest. It's Dr. Nick Thompson. Hi, Nick.
Hello there. How are you doing, Kat?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for joining me today. I appreciate you're a very busy man.
It's good to be here.
Oh, good stuff. Okay, so if anyone doesn't know who Dr. Nick Thompson is, let me tell you a little bit of info. So Dr. Nick is otherwise known as the Gut Doctor and has been a practicing holistic veterinarian for over 30 years, covering modalities such as natural nutrition, herbal medicine, and homeopathy. Dr. Nick helps animals worldwide with their ongoing health problems. In 1999, Dr. Nick established his specialist practice, Holistic Vet, now based near Bath. He offers homeopathy, natural nutrition, herbal medicine, and good old-fashioned common sense for dogs and horses. His favourite topics are gastroenterology, the microbiome, and the misuse of pharmaceuticals in medicine. He loves researching all aspects of human and animal nutrition. Nick is the founding president of the International Raw Feeding Veterinary Society and has co-authored a pioneering worldwide survey of 79 vets and their experiences feeding raw food. He has co-organized international raw food conferences for the RFVS since 2014. Amongst many, many other projects, I do believe, Dr. Nick. Okay, so before we begin, I always like to ask, what was it that ignited the spark in you to work with animals in the first place? And what was it that inspired you to walk down the holistic path?
I think it's my parents, actually. My dad was a GP, my mum was a nurse, and they were both into alternative medicine. Mum was really into nutrition, even in the 70s, when, you know, nutrition wasn't really a major thing, really. She was into, you know, supplements to maintain health. She later in her life became an aromatherapist, working with essential oils, and had, you know, working with homeopathy and what have you. So all her life she was, you know, in that realm. My dad, we all went to New Zealand when I was about 14, lived there for a year. And while we were there, he got into using acupuncture and was using acupuncture for fertility and was able to help a number of couples have children just using acupuncture, which is pretty spectacular.
Wow, I think.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's always been... I was raised in that environment, and so it was kind of natural. I faint at the sight of human blood, especially my own. So being a doctor kind of is off the agenda. And so I've always really loved animals, and I've loved being out of doors and, you know, kind of, but, you know, working with people from the earth, essentially. Yeah. Farmers and horse owners and dog owners and what have you. And so it was only really natural that I went into some kind of healing profession. And because of my upbringing, it was almost inevitable that I was going to look at the alternative side. Yeah. Of medicine, really, you know, to because when you're at vet college, you get taught about pharmaceuticals and that pharmaceutical paradigm, but there's a whole wealth of opportunity to promote real health without using pharmaceuticals, okay? Yeah. Which you don't see if your toolbox is filled end to end with pharmaceutical solutions to problems. It is almost impossible for you to see beyond that, to say, well, hang on, the body's really good at making itself better anyway. Why don't we just enhance the body's own ability rather than going in with some very harsh, very targeted, very unphysiological synthetic drug, which they have their place. Don't get me wrong, you know, drugs do have their place, but there's a whole wealth of opportunity to help our animals get healthy without using those drugs, and that's very underused in the modern era.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you not faint at the sight of animal blood? Is it just human?
No, blood? I don't. I did.
That's
when
strange.
I thought, no, it's funny, isn't it? when I saw my first cat spay when I was probably 16 or so, seeing practice at a vet practice, I did feel a little bit lightheaded because there was a little bit of blood, but just got over that really, because I really wanted to be a vet. Since I was about 11, I wanted to be a vet. And so I just thought, yeah, come on, let's man up and crack on. So, no, I've seen quite a lot of blood in my time.
What an amazing experience it must have been, though, to be growing up in that kind of environment as well, because, like, environments like that are few and far between, especially now, aren't they, you know, sort of like...
Yeah, I guess they are, but...
They're coming back a bit, I think.
Yeah, people are getting more alternative. I think that there is a subgroup of people who, you know, in the COVID era has taught them that actually they are responsible for their own health. That, you know, and to realize that health is an incredibly precious thing. So yeah, there are more and more people who are looking outside a conventional paradigm. But for me, it was, they were just my parents. It's, you know, that's just the way it was. You don't realize what it is until you spend 6 years at vet college not having that input. You know, within 6 months of me qualifying, I was thinking, hang on, there must be more to this than I've been taught. Okay. And so I started my journey into holistic medicine within 6 months of getting into practice.
Wow. And what a grateful journey it has been so far.
It's been a ride, that's for sure.
So today I am particularly interested in discussing something you've briefly talked about anyway, in how drugs in particular can impact our dog's gut health. More specifically, and to explore what pet parents can kind of like consider or do to help support their pet, you know, like from with whole foods, especially if they do get prescribed long-term medication. So, you know, I mean, obviously you're aware of the fact that there are many dogs who take daily medication for sort of like pain and anxiety type things. And in my experience, when, you know, I help pet parents with their dog's diet and kind of like lifestyle changes in order to promote better health outcomes, but I find that it's often overlooked just how damaging these drugs can actually be to the microbiome and the gut in general, as amongst the other organs, of course. So I was hoping we could discuss the problems and solutions for pet parents to provide reassurance that they can, in fact, support their pets if they need to use this kind of thing. So firstly, what are the different drug groups and how do they impact our dog's gut health? I know this is such a broad question, so feel free to make it small.
There are thousands of drugs, but you can group them as you were suggesting in the question. So you could put them in various categories, and that's what we'll do just now. But basically, virtually every drug that you can take, from the mildest antihistamine to the most damaging chemotherapy, is likely to have an impact on your microbiome to a greater or lesser extent. When I say you, I mean your dog, okay? Because the impacts are very similar. So if there's a few which are much more prominent and much more studied. So antibiotics is the obvious one because they kill bugs, and your microbiome, which is a collection of bacteria and viruses and archaea, which are just kind of really ancient virus bacteria, and tiny little kind of protozoa, and little parasitic tiny micro filaria. All these, they all rely on each other to maintain an equilibrium. Okay, and antibiotics, and there are different types of antibiotics, but they will have some of the most profound effects. So that's kind of obvious. But if you look at things like the proton pump inhibitors, these are the omeprazoles, these are drugs that are used extensively in human medicine. Some of the most common drugs used in the world are to reduce acid in the stomach, and they can have effects as well on the microbiome. Okay, another one is called metformin, which is used, it's a diabetes drug. Before you go onto insulin, some doctors will put some humans on metformin, and you wouldn't have thought that that would influence your microbiome, but actually it does. One of the big ones is non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. This is the Metacams, the Prebicoxes of this world. They have a really pretty profound effect on the microbiome in several different ways, and I'd love to go through that. I've been asked recently to do some writing on the topic, so I've got some really useful notes. But also antipsychotics, these are the drugs that we take to help with anxiety, and these selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac and what have you. These are used in veterinary medicine now. They have an effect on the microbiome, and chemotherapeutic drugs do. You know, they're very, very, very potent and damaging, which is why they're chosen. And so, yeah, pretty much think of a drug, and it's going to have, directly or indirectly, is going to have an effect on the microbiome.
Okay, so coming back to kind of like the NSAIDs, because in my experience, I find that there are a lot of dogs on NSAIDs on a daily basis for a long time to manage like pain and stuff. So if a dog is on this kind of long-term pain medication, what kind of impact is that having on their gut on a daily basis?
Okay, so I've got I've done some extensive notes on these. So I'm just going to take you through that, because it's really quite an interesting looking at the direct and indirect effects of non-steroidals on the gut. Is kind of it's a very good way to understand the many different ways in which that the drugs going in your mouth, or not even in your mouth, even onto your skin, can affect your microbiome. Okay, so non-steroidal anti-inflammatories are designed to inhibit this an enzyme called cyclooxygenase. These are the COX enzymes. There's a COX-1 and a COX-2, and the COX-1 and COX-2 enzymes are a part of producing prostaglandins. Okay, prostaglandins are funny little lipid compounds, and what they do in the gut is they help to maintain the mucus layer, the lining of the stomach and the intestines. Okay, and they also regulate the blood flow. Okay, so they have this dual action. In the normal gut, prostaglandins keep a good healthy layer of mucus and make sure that you're getting good blood supply. And what happens is when a dog takes a non-steroidal like Metacam or Loxicom, those are the same thing, but I'll just say it just so that people can lock onto it. Yeah, so Metacam, Loxicom, Inflacam, all of these, they are all based on meloxicam. That's the generic. That's the molecule that does all the work.
Is Galliprant included in that as well?
Galliprant is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, but it doesn't contain meloxicam. It's much newer. Okay. Metacam came out years ago, and it's been around for a long time. And actually, I don't like it because I see the dogs whose guts are affected by it quite often. Anyway, so back to the story of how non-steroidals. So the normal gut looks after this layer of mucus and makes sure there's plenty of blood. Once you take a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, you get thinning of that essential mucus layer, and you get a decrease in the blood supply, which devitalizes the health of the gut. Okay, so it means that the intestine is more vulnerable to damage. Okay, so it's you're looking at irritation of the surface of the gut. You're looking at erosions, which is a small, you know, like if you scuff your knee, that's an erosion, or an ulcer, which is where you've actually got a hole in the surface of your gut. And that's one of the main effects. Okay. And so by changing those two elements, the blood supply and the mucus, that will actually have a direct effect on the ecosystem. Because what the gut does, the gut lining is a bit like a farmer, and it farms all the bugs within the gut, within the microbiome. And that's the farmer is therefore compromised by the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. Okay. So when that barrier is weakened, bacteria or their byproducts, like the lipopolysaccharides, okay, they are able to go through this protective lining into the gut and therefore further damage the gut. And actually, they can slip into the bloodstream, which can provoke. So this is why dogs who have IBD can then have other inflammatory diseases like skin disease, okay, because you've got these toxic elements that should just be within the gut actually entering the gut lining and into the blood beyond. And they've actually done studies whereby and they've actually measured it, that you can boost the enterobacteria, which is the enterobacteria is one of some of the most common. These are the kind of the poo bacteria, and that can boost those, but it can cut down on bifidobacteria and cut down on lactobacilli, and those two are really critical to the stability of the gut. So that's the kind of the most obvious, is that it has an effect on the lining of the gut. But there are ibuprofen, for example, which we don't really use in veterinary medicine, but in people, ibuprofen can form these kind of complexes, and then the gut bacteria come along and they then hydrolyze that ibuprofen bacteria conjugate, okay, and that releases some nasty irritating compounds which can further irritate the lining of the gut, and that inflammation of the gut means that the farmer is even less happy, which means that there's even more disruption within the microbiome. Now, beyond the physical damage that we've just described, what they can do, they can kind of how would you describe it? They can kind of change the gut's the chemical landscape. Okay, they can reduce the pH, reduce the acidity, or they can change the bile acid flow. Yeah, because prostaglandins, which are affected by the non-steroidals, will affect the bile secretion, which will then that because there are some bugs which require bile to flourish, and if that's compromised, they will be compromised. Okay, so not only that, there was a researcher called Mayer in 2018 found that non-steroidals actually change the gene expression of certain bacteria within the gut. Yeah. And wow, that can change the bacteria. So therefore that changes carbohydrate metabolism, can change how the bacteria that then are able to adapt to any changes, because the gut changes with every meal. Mm-hmm. And makes it less resilient, more fragile. And so that's a very long answer to say that non-steroidals do a lot. Potentially, no, they will affect the gut in every animal who takes them. But that will be seen more in some animals than others.
Okay, so that's absolutely fascinating, and it's so good to know. So thank you for sharing all of that valuable insight. Okay. because information like this is not made readily available to the pet parents who
well, it kind of is. If you medication. Look, I deal mainly with dogs these days, so I'm going to talk mainly about dogs. Okay, okay. You've got to be quite careful with non-steroidals and cats. But so we'll just talk about dogs for now. If you look on the side of the a pot of your prescription of Metacam, for example, it mm-hmm. will say on the label that you get from the vet, words to the effect of stop dosing if you see any gut signs like vomiting or diarrhea.
All right, okay, yeah, but that is not in nowhere by comparison to the explanation that you've just given us.
It might be quite difficult to fit everything I've just said on one label. Yeah, you're yeah. right. But it does mean though that
yeah.
that the frequency of getting problems with something like Metacam is high enough for them to justify putting that lettering on every yeah. single bottle of non-steroidal that goes out of the practice.
Absolutely. And is it only with long-term use, or is this kind of nope. disruption?
They can start with within one or two doses.
So say for instance a dog has surgery and they're given Metacam for the for post-surgery pain.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even if the pet parent only gives maybe one or two doses, they can still experience this damage, which then my next question, does this impact then on their gut keep them in the cycle of damage, or are they likely to recover, or would they need to kind of do some more strategic yeah. work on improving their gut health?
Okay, it depends on how much damage is done. Okay, and mm-hmm. the less you use, the less likely you are to do lots of damage. Yeah, so there are some dogs who you can put on Metacam for years, and they'd seem yeah. absolutely fine. There will be changes in microbiome for the above reasons, but they are less susceptible to change in their prostaglandin metabolism, we could say. Okay, and there are some dogs that they're a little bit lame, they go to the vets, they get a bit of Metacam, and within a day or two they've got a hemorrhagic gastroenteritis. And I've seen some cases where we cannot stop that recurrent inflammatory change in their gut.
Even when this medication is stopped?
Even when you remove the medication. Yeah, these are absolutely painful cases, because yeah. you know what's caused it. You've withdrawn what's caused it. You've improved the diet. You're doing so much to heal the gut. And yet the gut is permanently damaged as a result. They cannot, you know, they are permanently in pain, or they're permanently have signs of enteritis, pancreatitis, poor digestion, yeah. all sorts of downstream effects of taking even a short course of the Metacam. I'm not saying that dogs and cats and any animal who's undergone surgery shouldn't have pain relief. I'm just yeah. saying, I think we need to be a little bit careful about what we choose, because there's lots of ways to damp down pain that don't involve non-steroidal anti-inflammatories as well. Okay. Yeah. So
absolutely. So is it just oral medication that has this impact on the gut?
No, actually, Rodney Habib did some studies a few years ago where he did microbiome testing before and after drop on, you know, the kind of Advantage Advocate, those kind of drop ons that you get for fleas and ticks. Yeah. And very simple, he just did a microbiome test before and after using these types of products and found that there was a measurable difference.
So would that be the same for vaccines as well?
I think that all pharmaceuticals have the potential to affect the microbiome. And one of the examples of that is, if you think back to 1998, there was a guy called Andy Wakefield, who infamous and who got drummed out of the British medical establishment for this. He said, is there a relationship between MMR vaccine, gut damage, and autism? Okay, and this is all very, you know, in the news at the moment because of Kennedy and what have you. And there seems to be a lot of evidence to link autism to certain types of vaccination. And what he noticed, because he's an enterologist, he was looking at children who had gut problems and was able to hypothesize that maybe it was the vaccine which was causing the gut damage, and somehow, and he didn't know how, the gut damage was then leading to autistic problems, because many possibly even all kids with autism have gut issues.
Yeah, it's so fascinating that the studies that are out,
they're coming out thick and fast now.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, we've been denying it for 27 years, but you know, I've been suspicious. I think Andrew Wakefield is absolutely fantastic. He's a very very honorable, noble, and a very rigorous researcher, and he gets my vote. Actually, my children have not been vaccinated.
Yeah, I know. It's one of those subjects as well that is kind of, it's so controversial in the public space as well, isn't it? Because everybody's,
yeah, but just because it's controversial doesn't mean that we shouldn't bring science there. You know,
I think conditioned is a better word, you know, to use.
Conditioned is a better word. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. It's
well, exactly. You know, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you cannot.
Exactly right.
Cannot...
And the
there shouldn't be anything in science that you cannot question. But if you start questioning vaccines, then your grant funding is going to just disappear immediately. You know, yeah. it you're not allowed to. And if there's an amazing book called Turtles All the Way Down. Yeah, it's in a white cover, and it's by Anonymous, because they didn't want to you know, be thrown out of the medical profession. And it goes through the American childhood vaccination schedule, which is horrendous. Something like 84 vaccines by the time a kid is 18.
Wow.
And
it's
yeah,
legal, it's law in some places as well, isn't it? Like, you, it's illegal not to have them.
There is
vaccines,
it's illegal, like, you can't go to school without them and things like that. Yeah. And what they've shown in the book is that there is no placebo controlled trials of what does this vaccine do relative to no vaccine at all. They always test a vaccine against some other vaccine, so that therefore if they're both causing side effects, it won't be too visible.
Yeah, when if you actually did a
but
study
that's controversial
compared...
okay yeah
and that's a whole different topic for a different
yeah but
day.
I think we need to, yeah, good science, yeah, says do. Just, you know, let's
Well, that's what science is all about, isn't it? It's about, you know, questioning things. And there is plenty of science that has been found to be wrong, you know, over the course of history as well. So it absolutely should be. And it's really interesting.
It shouldn't be off limits. Yeah.
It should be. And I think it's really interesting because there are so many kind of behavioral problems showing up in dogs as well today. And we know that dogs are over vaccinated as well. So maybe there might be some correlations in there as well. Who knows?
Maybe maybe the vaccines are affecting microbiome.
Yeah.
You know, and microbiome can affect, you know, 80% of serotonin is produced in the gut. If your gut is unhappy because your microbiome's unhappy, that's going to change your serotonin. You change your serotonin, you will get changes in behavior. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you cannot underestimate how profound the effect of the microbiome is in all sorts of conditions. For example, very briefly, I don't want to bore you, but they've raised mice without any microbiome. Okay. They don't last very long, but they can raise them, and they have other mice. And they'll take gut contents from obese mice and put those into these normal but sterile mice, and they become obese. Okay. Yeah. That is an actual study that if you go on YouTube or Google, you'll be able to find those studies very easily. That's pretty remarkable, but that shows how influential the microbiome is. You know, it's not just your genes, it's actually what's happening in all this soup in your gut. But they've done the same. They've taken the gut contents of anxious mice, they breed these anxious mice, and they put those into these notobiotic, these kind of sterile mice, and they become more anxious than they were before the transplant. So it's enormous, the profundity of,
and that's what they've found with dogs as well, isn't it?
They found I haven't seen anything recently,
dogs who,
you tell me.
Okay, so I was going to say that they have found that dogs who share a household with a person that is autistic have some of the bacteria in their gut that are commonly found in people with autism, haven't they? So that's sort of like similar, but it hasn't.
That
been
is similar. That's a nice study, what they have shown is that children who are raised, I think it was the University of Columbia, they did some studies showing that children who are raised in households with pets, particularly dogs, have a reduced tendency to get asthma and eczema and other kind of immune type diseases.
I can believe that. My little girl Bailey gets sick, to be honest. She's quite good. I think she's got a stronger immune system than the whole house, if I'm being completely honest with you. But she's one for getting her hands dirty in the garden, planting the seeds and stuff. So she likes to.
Oh, great. Okay. So this is your daughter. I didn't know whether you're talking about your okay, right. I think it's really healthy. I've raised my son is 12 and my daughter is 11 now, and they've been raised with dogs, and the dogs have been eating raw, and there's bones on the floor and all sorts. I mean, it's safe. Nobody's ever got any infection, but I think it's a very healthy way to be. Arthur's almost never, I don't think he has had an antibiotic, and Ophelia only had an antibiotic because she got bitten by a tick that turned into a target, and I didn't want her getting Lyme disease.
Yeah.
So she went on like 3 weeks of antibiotics, which killed me to do. But she was about 6 or 7 at the time. She wasn't a baby. There's a researcher called Martin Blaser who did a paper in 2016, and he suggests that early life exposure, and I'm talking even kind of trace amounts in utero from mum, or just small amounts in infancy, can irreversibly alter the microbial development, okay, and can increase the risk of obesity later, okay?
Wow.
So that means you have exposure when you're really young and no antibiotics for the rest of your life, and that can change your risk of obesity later in life.
You can't believe it's the truth, can you? Sometimes.
Oh, yeah. I can well believe it. I very much can believe it. You know,
I think it's because of the way we are conditioned, everyone, in my experience, struggles to believe something so simple, you know, because it does seem like it's so simple when you break it down, doesn't it? But I think, you know, because when there's all these complex problems like chronic issues and we talk about them being related to the gut and stuff, people mm-hmm. can't conceptualize that it can all just boil down to the health of one, you know, the health of one organ because it's been happening for so long and everything like that. I don't know if that's the same.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I know. I think it's a good point. I think what's happened is that ever since they were invented in the 30s and 40s, Alexander Fleming and all that stuff, they've been touted as being safe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it was only, I mean, this guy, Martin Blaser, he's been looking at this for 20 years or so. He's saying, well, actually, guys, there are societal problems from the overuse of antibiotics because, you know, up until, I don't know, the 90s, maybe the early 2000s, antibiotics were used like Smarties. You know, you have a cold, go to the doctor, they'll give you a course of antibiotics. You know, now they don't, okay, because they know that that's a really bad idea. If you look in the mm-hmm. States, 70% of antibiotic use goes into animals who are raised in CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations. Yeah, 70% of antibiotics, which then promotes antibiotic resistance. That's right. And also it will contaminate.
Okay.
Contaminate the meat and then come through the meat and go into animals and humans who eat that meat.
Yeah, it's a sad situation, but hopefully mm-hmm. that's about to change as well.
I hope so.
Yeah. Okay, so coming back to kind of like gut-related symptoms, what if a dog is prescribed medication, whether it is an NSAID or any kind of other medication, what gut-related symptoms would you typically associate with that as being a problem from the medication? You know what I mean? So would it just be something like vomiting and diarrhea? Yeah.
Vomiting and diarrhea are the most obvious, but there's a lot of dogs who are getting GERD, reflux. Yeah, mm-hmm. reflux disease. Or lip smacking, things like that. There's a lot more. Yeah, I think in the last 10 years, it's become a real thing. And I'm seeing more and more cases like that. So that's you know, anything gutty, essentially. You'd be suspicious of it. The trick is to avoid the using these drugs if at all possible. Have that conversation with the vet to say, is this absolutely essential? Are there any alternatives?
Okay. Yeah, that would be a good place to start. I don't know how that conversation would go down with the...
Doesn't matter. You've got to have it. You are obliged to have that conversation.
Yeah, and it is your right to question and, you know, and explore these kinds of things anyway. So even just asking questions about the side effects and stuff as well, because I find a lot of pet parents don't ask that many questions either for a various number of reasons. Maybe because we're conditioned just to kind of go and get the pill and that fixes the problem again, you know, a societal problem, as you previously mentioned. But one of the things I was kind of, curious about, I think, you know, if our dog is struggling with something, then in your opinion, would you say that the gut is more than likely implicated already before you then go in with the medication? You know,
what do you mean?
Because there is,
sorry.
So because the dog is already experiencing a problem, whether it's pain or whether it's sort of like, whether it is kind of like a GI issue anyway, and then we give a medication, can you know, would you say in your opinion that the gut is already kind of suffering some kind of imbalance because there is this sort of disease type thing? Does that make sense?
Okay, so if, so if the dog is lame and they get Metacam because they're lame, then it's like, it's likely their gut is probably okay, but then can be disrupted by the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. However, if they go in with gastroenteritis, with hemorrhagic gastroenteritis, with pancreatitis, with, you know, some or other issue, if they are then given non-steroidals, then that could add insult to injury, logically.
Okay. And what about if they've got kind of like liver or kidney disease or something like that as well? Would you usually find that the gut is implicated before in those diseases?
If you've got kidney disease and disruption of microbiome is well recognized, liver disease for even more obvious reasons, for bile circulation of bile, production of bile, detoxification of products of digestion. So yes, and pancreatitis as well will have an effect on inflammation of the gut, especially the upper small intestine, which can, and then any change in the wall of the gut can then have a rebound effect on the microbiome. Yeah, because remember, that's the farmer. The gut, the actual tube, is the farmer which farms all the bugs within the gut itself.
Yeah, and they're all, you know, well, pancreatitis is a horrific kind of, it's a horrific condition anyway, isn't it, itself? And the pancreas is used to digest the food as well.
It is. So if you're not digesting, if you've got pancreatitis and your pancreas is producing half the amount of digestive enzymes, this is the amylases, the lipases, the proteases, then you're not going to digest the food in the part of the gut where it's supposed to be digested. Yeah, because it's a production line. Okay. Yeah. So it means in a production line, if things go wrong at the top of the production line, then things go wrong all the way down that production line, because the guy at the beginning of the production line dropped a hammer into the engine of the car.
Yeah.
So it has downstream effects all the way. So So that's why the liver disease, pancreatic disease. That's why using omeprazole, for example, is to reduce the acid should be avoided where possible, because the system is set up such that you digest food in an acid environment in your stomach. That's then squirted into the duodenum. That injection of acid material stimulates the pancreas to produce pancreatic fluid, which is an alkaline, which mixes with the acid, which then has a neutralizing effect on the food as it flows down out of the stomach. If you're taking omeprazole, to reduce the acid in the stomach, then there's less acid going in, so there's less stimulation for the pancreas to do its job. Therefore, you're going to get maldigestion of food lower down in the digestive tract,
which is a different problem aside from the one that you already.
Well, it's the guy at the beginning of the production line drops a hammer in the engine. That's exactly what it's like.
It's a good way to think about it, really. Again, I think because we have a tendency to focus on individual aspects.
Yeah.
By knowing how the whole production line works, it really helps people to understand the severity of the impact of the drugs and stuff. But okay, so
Just in the last 9 minutes, I've got to get my dogs. I've got a meeting of the Raw Feeding Veterinary Society, which everybody's welcome to come and join us. We're just a family of people working together to promote raw food. But I've got a meeting at 6 and I've got to get my dogs out while it's not raining, at about from 5 till 6, hopefully.
Okay. Last question then. If pet parents do find themselves in a situation where they do have to put on their dogs on medication, whether it's short term or long term, what can they do to help support their dogs through this whole process? Again, I know it's hard to kind of give a one size fits all approach, but
sure, but there are some broad strokes, Kat, that we can look at. I mean, the first thing for me would be, if at all possible, try and get your dog on a raw food diet, or cat on a raw food diet, because my experience suggests over the last 25 years is that the raw fed dog and cat go to the vet less. It means that they've got a more resilient gut. The gut is more of an archetypal. It's more of an ancient gut, because if you're feeding a dog or a cat on ultra processed food, you're going to have you're not going to have a kind of an ancient balance of bacteria, you know, by definition. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you mm-hmm. give modern food, you'll get a modern microbiome, whereas humans have had an ancient microbiome for 3 million years. Dogs have had an ancient microbiome for 45 million years. Okay. So if you feed that 45 million year old microbiome on ultra processed modern food, you're not going to get a good range of healthy bacteria by definition. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'd say feeding a raw food diet is a great idea. The way to start with raw is just contact one of the reputable raw food companies and have a chat with them, and they will take you through the process. The transition process is very, very easy. Okay, so that would be the first thing to do. The second thing to do, if you're feeding a raw or fresh food diet and that's all going very well, but you have to feed you have to give Metacam, for example, or we'll just say that, for example. Okay, so what would you do to protect? Well, you try and not use Metacam. That would be the first thing. Yeah. But let's say you use something else and the dog was sensitive to something else. What would you do? There are some really lovely products like slippery elm and marshmallow root. Mm-hmm. are very good as prebiotics. There's a very nice, what's it called? It's by ProDog Raw. Let me grab, they do a really nice kind of support product. Let me just grab that for you. Digest, of course it's called Digest. Okay, so they've got this product, okay, called Digest. Supports digestive function, helps to maintain the balance. If there's inflammation there, promotes detox within the gut. Really, really nice. And that is a brilliant one to look at. Let me just tell you what's in it, because that's pretty spectacular.
And this is really simple for pet parents to use as well, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, seriously. So, ProDog Raw, it's called Digest Gut Health, okay? And it contains, wait for it, you're going to love this. So it contains marshmallow root, aloe vera, which is very calming to the gut, slippery elm, which we've mentioned, chamomile. Again, chamomile is known as the mother of the gut. It contains ox bile. How cool is that? Okay, to help with emulsification of fats. Contains L-glutamine to feed the enterocytes. Contains astaxanthin, which is a really potent antioxidant. Contains chia seed, which is a prebiotic, makes your bugs really, really happy. Pumpkin seed powder, which is prebiotic and also has a reputation for helping eliminate worms. It's got licorice root powder. Licorice is very calming, anti-inflammatory to the gut. Chlorella is very nutritious to the gut. Psyllium husk helps with As a prebiotic, and if there's any constipation, psyllium can be really useful. There's a bit of parsley leaf in there as well, full of potassium and some really very nice prebiotic. It's quite finely divided, and there are some digestive enzymes. So if your pancreas is on a bit of a go slow, they can help to break down the food processes. So that's a really nice one to look at, and we do that. If you look on the holisticvet.shop, we stock that one because we think it's such a nice blend of elements. So that would be one to think about. It's called Digest because it helps your digestion.
Okay, that's fantastic. So there is light at the end of the tunnel for dogs that do need to be on medication.
Yeah.
But I think you did previously mention as well to always kind of be open to discussing alternatives, especially when it comes to things like NSAIDs as well.
I think it's not unreasonable with your vet to say to your vet when they hand you the Metacam, is that the only medicine that we could use at this in this stage? I just think I see too many problems with Metacam. I'm sure there are loads of dogs who can take it, yeah. But there are some much more modern drugs which are designed to be more prostaglandin sparing. Okay, these would be the Galliprants, the Simaljex of this world, and they're just tolerated. But Metacam, it's a bit old.
Yeah.
Okay. The manufacturers won't be very happy if I say that, but that's the bottom line. Google, when did it first go on the market, and then look at something like Galliprant, which only came on the market what, 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
Yeah
it's a more clever drug, and if you have to take a drug, if it's more highly engineered to so that it's sparing of prostaglandins, for example, then that's got to be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, thank you ever so much for sparing time out of your busy schedule to share all of your wisdom with us, and it's much appreciated. I do appreciate it very much, and I'm sure our listeners do too. So
bless you. Thank you, Kat. It's been absolutely great. Keep up the good work. You're doing some fantastic work getting the getting some important information out there. So I support you wholeheartedly.
Thank you so much. And for everyone listening, I will include all of Dr. Nick's information in the show notes as usual, so if you want to check out the shop and the ProDog Raw product, or just maybe having a consultation with Dr. Nick and looking at his website, then all of the information will be there. Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Nick, and we will talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot, Kat.
Thanks for listening to another great episode of the My Dog Made Me Do It Naturally podcast. Don't forget to check out the caption for any links discussed here today. And please, if you enjoyed the show, follow along and listen for free on your favourite podcast app. If you have any questions or would like to share your story, feel free to email me at mydogmademedoitnaturally@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Purpose of this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be substituted as advice from a veterinarian or other professional. It does not form a client relationship with me, the host, or any guest speakers, and any information is not intended to and does not diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent disease. And my guests express our own views, thoughts, and opinions as individuals, and the podcast neither endorses or opposes the views, products, or services discussed here. If your pet is ill, always seek advice from your veterinarian. I am not a veterinarian and I do not treat disease or offer medical advice.